Describe what we're going to see on the 12th. What's your set going to be like?
Just like pure domination.
Yeah.
How long you got? 45 minutes?
Like, I mean, like, picture the fire emoji, you know, but like...
On stage with the
keyboard. Yeah, on stage with that. Well, there's no keyboard. I'm going to be playing guitar and singing and playing some pre-recorded backing tracks and just killing it as hard as one is able to do given those, you know...
Parameters.
Right. That's a great word.
In the context of it all.
Context.
Right.
Thank you, guys.
Guess who's back? Carlos is. Back again. Shady's back. I am too. Tell a friend. Guess who's back? 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 What's up, everyone? Thanks so much for joining me. It's been too long. Actually, a little over a month and change. And we'll get into why, but it's great to be back with you here. On this episode, San Francisco singer-songwriters Theodore Atwood and Goose Ignite, as well as Oakland-based author Kristen McCloy, discussing her upcoming book, as well as news from the world of politics and entertainment. It's so good to be back here with you guys. Welcome back. This is The Carlos Show on JakeRadioLive.com.
Ridiculous. It's a radio show. It ain't a one-hour television spectacular.
From my cold, dead hand.
I gotta start here, folks. On Sunday, the great Ginger Baker, perhaps one of the greatest drummers of all time, passed away at the age of 80. I cannot even begin to state this man's contributions to music. What you have to realize is in the 60s, the drums changed in terms of having a role within the rock and roll context. Prior to that, pretty much from when Elvis started in the late 50s up until the mid 60s, the rock and roll drummer was more of a timekeeping device. It was simple. It was like, it was very simplistic. It was almost like a click track. And then once you get to people like Ginger Baker or John Densmore of The Doors, Keith Moon of The Who, Ian Paice of Deep Purple, and especially even people like Mitch Mitchell of the Hendrix Experience. These were all guys who were raised on jazz. So their playing was much more busy. There were more dense clusters. They were using the totality of the drum kit more. So in the 60s, the drum kit became a major force, a different voice in the orchestra that was the rock band, if you will. And Ginger Baker was at the forefront of that. He played with Fela Kuti. He was one of the first drummers to popularize using the double bass. For those of you who don't know, two kick drum drums, and he was just incredible. And any of you who want to know more about him, I would suggest you look at the documentary that came out a few years ago, Beware of Mr. Baker. And not only was, my friend Anthony put it, that he was not only one of the greatest drummers of all time, but also one of the most famous curmudgeons, because this guy had an attitude. And in the, he was very angry. And in the documentary, he literally breaks the filmmaker's nose on camera with his cane. He was crazy, but he brought that lunacy to the drum kit, and he will forever be missed. But his place is solidified in the world of rock. I had to start there because that just happened on Sunday. And a lot of stuff has happened since I talked to you guys last. It's been a little over, it's been over a month, let's just say. Couple reasons why the last show, the Tarantino episode, was delayed in getting onto the actual site a couple weeks. I went to LA. And then there was just kind of this feeling I had about, I don't want to just rant for 20 minutes and give them a substandard, episode. And I wanted to really feel the episode. So we got some people on today to interview and talk to. And we'll hear more about that later. But I would like to touch on a couple things that have been going on in the news in the time that I've talked to you. I don't want to add to the noise pollution about Trump too much, but it's worth mentioning. I mean, once you start talking impeachment, I'm sorry, that's a whole different ballgame. And I'm not going to, you guys all know what happened about July 25th or so. The president made a phone call to Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, and he heavily inferred that he was going to withhold the, he didn't say it, but it's very inferred that the U.S. has, you know, provided aid to the Ukraine. They had $391 million bookmarked to provide to that nation for various military reasons, such as equipment, enemy detection, intelligence, personnel salaries. And in the phone call, of course, Trump very much infers that, hey, we'll give you this, but I need some dirt on Joe Biden and his son. Now, you know, in order to get a president impeached, here's my feeling about the whole thing. I'll just bottom line it. I think he should be removed from office. I don't think it will happen, but I think it's time. I don't know what a person needs to do to demonstrate that he is an unfit leader. But to impeach a president in this country, you essentially have to prove that they have, you know, their wrongdoings have reached the levels of high crimes and misdemeanors. So does that mean you have to attach it to a law? I don't know. I mean, a sitting president putting pressure on a world leader, threatening to withhold financial security aid unless that foreign leader provided dirt on his political rival. Are you kidding me? What is dirtier than that? I mean, what are you going to tell me next? Did he bang a porn star and pay her off? Let's talk to his first attorney. Oh, he's in prison. What are you going to tell me next? That some of his business associates conspired with Russian business leaders and diplomats to influence the 2016 election? Oh, it's not like he did that at all. What is it going to take? Okay, you know, and I want him to be removed from office because I want the morale in this country to improve. I mean, to say it's just been divisive is a massive understatement. People are going crazy. I mean, it's taken over all news outlets. It's taken over every single comedy show. I mean, and I think Trump is loving it. I think it will just, you know, it's like this country is a boiling pot right now, and it will definitely turn down the fire by getting this guy out of here. I don't want to get rid of him because I don't like him, because I don't like his face or even what he said in the past. I mean, a lot of people from day one were like, you know, impeach this motherfucker. They just don't like him. It's funny, the same people who think that Trump, you know, insults people's appearance, and he does, and is just gross about what he says about others, you know, they will also insult Trump's appearance. So I think that, and, you know, call him orange, and he's just got fake hair and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, that's playing into what he wants. He's just completely degraded the morale of this country, and I just can't wait. Can you imagine the celebrations in the streets if Trump is impeached and removed from office? Can you imagine what's going to happen? Let me tell you something. As I sit here in lovely Berkeley, California today, this past election, the 2016 election, I went to an election party. And when I was realizing that Trump was probably going to win, I left early because I'm like, I know there's going to be problems in the streets, riots or something, as some kind of, you know, expression of displeasure over the election of this asshole. And so I left the party early. 8 years before, in 2008, I was in the same house, the same election party, and Obama won. And I left, I think, a little earlier. I just made sure I wasn't out on the streets because it was a different kind of outpouring. It was like a celebration. You think Berkeley would have when Obama won, it was like Berkeley had a baseball team and they won the World Series. I mean, it was just elation on the streets of Berkeley and all over the Bay Area. And we need the morale back. I'm sick of it being, I mean, everywhere I go, Trump is the central point of conversation. It's getting old. It's getting old. It's just going to be a dark stain on our history and, you know, doesn't make us look good abroad. Who's going to replace him eventually? I don't know. But what does a guy have to do to show, like I said, what does he have to do to show that, you know, he's just ineffective and bad for the country? I don't know. I really don't know. Oh, man, what else happened when I was, just a couple things while there was a little gap in programming here. I guess I'll go into Tekashi 6ix9ine in the world of hip-hop music. For those of you who don't know, Tekashi 6ix9ine is a 23-year-old rapper from Brooklyn, and he's been involved with with the gangs all his life. And apparently, you know, he was indicted. He was arrested and looking at 47 years in the hole. He was looking at 47 years in prison for racketeering, arms trading, drug dealing, conspiracy to murder. And he started singing like a canary. And I hope that some of that singing is better than his shit music, because I got to tell you, like, I have nothing personal against him. But when Tekashi 6ix9ine and Cardi B came out, I was like, I never heard their music. I keep seeing them in, like, they're like on the, you know, TMZ or on CNN for all this stuff they're saying. And they're kind of all over the news. I've never heard one track. And I tried to listen to the tracks, and it was just garbage on both parts. It's all like, I got my Benz, I got my rim. It's all like what they got. So your first track, you're showing me how rich you are. So I never thought much of him. I thought he was kind of a joke with his rainbow hair and tattoos all over his face, which I never will understand why someone would want to do that to themselves. But he was staring down the barrel at 47 years. And he's 23 years old. He would have gotten out when he was 70. Now, he's been snitching on a lot of his former gang members and his friends and people he's worked with. And he's hoping to get that sentence reduced. I guess people have already been arrested and charged as a result of his testimony. And a lot of gang members and people in Dark Life would say that Tekashi 6ix9ine is a snitch. He's a piece of shit. He's dishonorable. He has gone against, you know, he's gone against gang code. And let's look at that gang code. Like, he's 23 now. He would have gotten out when he was 70. So he could have, you know, done his time maybe and lived up to that gang code. And, you know, I think he's a blood. I don't know what branch of bloods, because they seem to be divided like, you know, offices now, but he's a blood. And he was looking at spending the rest of his life essentially in the can. He's got a daughter. He's got a young daughter. So what are you going to do? Are you going to go do 47 years in the can and live up to gang honor? Or do you want to be able to go to a park someday and throw a ball with your daughter? Do you want to see her grow up? Do you want to spend time with your partner and your friends and go do normal things? So I think he made the right choice. I didn't know much about he's only 23. I didn't know a whole lot about his background, but I know he lost his dad when he was 13. He tried to make money working in restaurants, being a busboy so he could support his family. He has an older brother who became the patriarch. I guess his real name is, Tekashi 6ix9ine's real name is Daniel Hernandez. And he has an older brother, I believe Oscar, who took over that fatherly role. And then Tekashi just got involved in nightlife and gang life and as a way to make money. And he just went too deep. He just went too far. And then looking at a half century behind bars, he started snitching. And I can't say he's doing the right thing, the wrong thing. What would you do? At that point, you'll never see your family again. Do you really give a fuck what gang members think of? What their opinions are about you? But I guess there was the assumption he was going to go into witness protection. And it looks like he has chosen to, when he's released, whenever that is, he's going to have 24-hour security for the rest of his life. Sorry, brother. They're coming for you. They're coming for you. So lots of luck, but I predict that, you know, I mean, think about all the people that are going to come after him. I give it a couple years before the inevitable result occurs. And I wish him luck, and, you know, if he can make more music and see that career develop and see his songs evolve and his vision, I don't know. I wonder when the element of violence and hip-hop are going to be separated permanently. I wonder when, you know, in 10 years, will someone open up, like, some newspaper or look online and see a bunch of hip-hop artists coming to the Oakland Arena? Because every time I see that, I'm like, there's going to be a shooting at the fucking Oakland Arena. Every time I hear about a big... But that's been ingrained in me for years. You know, every time they advertise for the Source Awards, I'm like, uh-oh. Uh-oh, someone's getting shot. I don't think I'm alone in that. And don't tell me I am. But I hope it works out for Tekashi 6ix9ine in whatever way it can, and wish him the best of luck. Also, during the break, something happened in the last month. This happened a couple weeks ago, and I just felt a little strongly about it, because we live in a bullshit time of woke outrage and cancel culture when, you know, we're supposed to pretend that things aren't funny, and people who are funny have to be very careful about insulting others. And it's killing comedy, it's killing entertainment, and it's not helping a single person. If this oversensitivity was helping at all, I would be all for it, but it's not. It's making everyone tense, and it's creating a lot of bullshit and dishonesty with the way people communicate. And a victim of that woke culture was the comedian Shane Gillis. Now, Shane Gillis was one of the lucky ones to be chosen to be on the new season 45 of Saturday Night Live. But they unearthed, I love when they say unearthed, they found some video clips, some internet clips of him making some, you know, questionable, semi-derogatory jokes about Chinese people. I don't know. You know, I think it seemed very spontaneous at the time. I don't think he was really thinking it through or trying to be hateful. But he'd already gotten the green light to be on SNL, to be on Saturday Night Live, just the pinnacle of anyone's comedy career. And then he was hired, the clip showed up, and he was fired. He was told he wasn't going to be on the show. Here's the problem about that. Now, I love that Shane Gillis kind of was like, well, I don't give a fuck. That's great. I love that attitude, because the guy is a funny stand-up. I did check him out. I'd heard of him before, but I hadn't heard his stuff, and he's pretty funny. But let's look at Saturday Night Live. It's been on for 45 years. Let me say that again. Saturday Night Live has been on for 45 years, and just now, for the first time, they got their first Asian American cast member, Bowen Yang. I mean, who's the racist? I mean, look at In Living Color and Mad TV. Those shows had Asian cast members from the jump, but it took Saturday Night Live 45 years to accept that, hey, Asian Americans are a regular part of society. They can be portrayed in dramatic and comedic sketches. Come on, who's the racist? Jesus, Shane Gillis didn't do shit wrong. I'm sorry. I mean, you're on a podcast, you're on stage, your mind is flowing. You're not thinking all the time of protecting every little subgroup, and come on. It's just getting absolutely ridiculous. And, you know, those are just some of the little tidbits that, while I was gone, stuck out in the news. The Trump thing is evolving, and I'm sure other things are going to pop up of note in the next, between now and the time I talk to you next. And we will discuss that. A great escape from all of that, as we all know, is music and arts and literature and stuff you enjoy and spending time with the best part of life, friends and family. But this week I interviewed a few people. I interviewed Bay Area author Kristen McCloy and San Francisco-based singer-songwriters Theodore Atwood and Goose Ignite. Now, Kristen McCloy has written three books. Velocity, which was released in 1988, garnering her critical acclaim, followed by Some Girls in 1994, followed by Hollywood Savage, which was released in 2010, all on major publishing houses. She is currently finishing up her fourth novel, entitled The Other Side of Me, which should be coming out soon. And we had a good discussion the other day about her career and about the new book. I have to say, it's funny, when I heard the interview the first time, it's a little NPR-ish. I don't know why. We were both kind of hushed. And I've made fun of, like, college radio and the tonality of NPR. But we did have a good discussion. This is my talk with Kristen McCloy on The Carlos Show. Kristen McCloy, it's been a long time. Good to see you.
Yeah, it's good to see you too, Carlos.
So you're working right now on your fourth book. Mm-hmm. It's called The Other Side of Me. Can you give me some kind of, you know, you don't have to spoil it, but brief synopsis of the plot and what we can look forward to?
Well, it's basically the story of two different people who come together just because they live across the street from each other. He's a comedian whose mother just died, and he just decided to retire, and she's a writer, and she's much older than he is, and it's sort of a story about older women and younger men without using stupid words like cougar. It's right. About comedy, it's also about addiction, and it has a happy ending.
Okay. And can you tell us where it's set?
It's set in Oakland, in the Laurel District. It's very localized.
Okay.
you know, writing today, we live at a time when there's a lot of fragmented media and splintered attention. You could almost argue that with the closure of stuff like Borders and all that stuff, that maybe not as many people are looking to read books, and, you know, maybe you don't have as many readers as you used to, any author. Does any of that affect you when you're writing, or do you think about that at all, in this day and age?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the social media is the meteor that killed, you know, it apparently is the dinosaur of authorship or writing books. And it does. It's made it very difficult. I've started 4 novels. I'm finishing one, I'm hoping.
Right.
Because I have fear. I have this fear that it's going to be rejected, that it's not going to sell, that my reputation isn't going to hold up. You know, all the natural self-doubt that comes with sitting by yourself and thinking.
And you ever get writer's block because of that? Or, yeah. You know, do you ever get writer's block at all?
It's more like I feel allergic to the book. I go through periods where suddenly I find the entire enterprise juvenile and the characters stupid, and there's a lot of repetition. You just go through periods where you just kind of, you don't really hate the book, but you just sort of can't stand to look at it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Do you have like kind of go-to friends that you will have them kind of edit you or just kind of give a first draft to, or you let them all be surprised when it comes out? How does that work?
Yeah, I want the surprise, but I do have a couple of friends who are also writers, and I trust their judgment because they like the same literature I do. So I will go to them when I'm really, really wondering, what is this good enough, or is this scene better than that scene? And my sister, who's a wonderful editor and writer herself, she edited my mother's memoir, 6 Car Lengths Behind an Elephant, which is about our lives growing up overseas.
Right. Well, we'll definitely get to that. When you were, you know, you were like, in 1988, your first book comes out, Velocity. In every artistic field, whether it be music or movies, sports even, there's always like an it person or like a flavor of the month that's like the most popular in their area. You were that for a minute in 88 in the literary world. Your first book, Velocity, was well reviewed. Mm-hmm. It was optioned for film. What was that like?
It was crazy. It was surreal. I went from, you know, working for $7.50 an hour as a temp to, you know, getting major bank for my first novel. It was translated into 13 countries and optioned by Robert Chartoff. So suddenly I had $250,000 and I was in my 20s. So I would feel really rich, but then I was living in Manhattan, and after a year I would feel really poor. It was just, it was very odd.
And how did you get that first, you know, bit of attention? Like, how do you go from finishing the manuscript to someone offering you a deal?
Well, I had an agent that I just sort of fluked into, which I think is how it most happens to most people. And she had a lot of relationships. She sold it to one editor at Random House, and a week later they bought it.
Wow. And does that, when you get that kind of acclaim early on, and does that affect how you approach, like, your sophomore effort or your overall writing process as a whole? I mean, you're in your 20s, and you have $250,000. You have an option to make your book into film. You have, you know, some interest in it by famous women who want to play the characters in the film. Does that affect the way you approach your writing thereafter?
Well, that made me completely delusional in that I thought I could always write a book and make a ton of money. And that's really funny to me now. But yeah, I was desperate to make a great book, my second book, and I realized that I didn't know how to write a book just because I'd written one. I don't know how to write the next one. It took me 5 years, a couple of identity crises, at least 2 nervous breakdowns before I finished Some Girls, but it was finally a success.
Right. And you want to tell the Madonna story? Madonna herself in the late 80s, along with actress Annabeth Gish, who later wanted to be, you know, Jean Triplehorn. Yeah. Madonna expressed interest in playing a character in your first book. Yeah. How does that happen?
I sent her the book, actually, as a fan, and I heard later that she went to the producer's office dressed in one of the outfits my character, Ellie, was dressed in, and said she wanted to play the part. And then she got in touch with me. She called me in my little East Village apartment where I was hanging out with my 3 boys, and it was an occasion for great joy.
3 boys, 3 pets?
No. My husband and my 2 best friends who happen to be gay.
Okay, gotcha. And you met her. You guys met up. Take me through that.
It was terrifying.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I met her at the studio. She was making like a prayer. That's how long ago this was.
The height of her fame, though.
Yeah.
We know.
Mm-hmm. She was married to Sean Penn and hanging out with Sandra Bernhardt. And And she was basically really a scary person. It was like, I don't know if you've ever gone to a public school, but it was like going into the girls' bathroom, and there are the girls that are like playing guitar and putting on eye makeup and hassling you and smoking cigarettes. She was that girl.
Wow, the tough kid.
The tough.
And what was she like when you met her?
That's what she was like when I met her, is what I'm saying.
What did she say to you?
She just expressed interest in the role, and I knew I did not want Madonna playing, trying to play vulnerable.
Really? Yeah. So you didn't think she was the best, you know, actress for the part?
No.
She didn't embody what it required. And how long, you know, you met her at a recording studio?
Yeah, I just hung out there. I was late, hungover, with my husband, who's being elaborately casual and making me really nervous. Uh-huh. And I couldn't think of a single thing to say to her because I did not want her in the movie. And so she said, well, are we going to do this? And I said, oh, you know, it's not really up to me. I don't really have it. But, you know, basically, if you're either with her or you're against her. And I think she picked up on that.
So you didn't want, so you're telling me you met the most famous singer and at that point, arguably the most famous woman in the mm-hmm. world. And you told her you didn't want her in you gave her the impression you didn't want her in the film. Why didn't you think she was right for it?
Because she would have to play vulnerable, and that's the one thing she cannot do.
Right.
So I just knew she'd ruin the movie.
Wow.
Yeah.
Madonna was acted in one of your...
Almost.
Crazy. Almost, yeah. Well, you mentioned before growing up overseas. I'm just going to say it out straight out. Your dad was in the CIA. Mm-hmm. God rest his soul. He's no longer with us, but what was it like being the daughter of a CIA father and moving to all these towns all over? Where all did you live?
I was born in San Francisco. I get to have that cachet on my passport.
Right.
And then we trained at the farm in Langley, Virginia.
Yeah.
And then eventually my father trained for his cover job and we moved to Madrid. And it was during the time of the Vietnam War, or right before that, actually, right around that time. And we were there for about 8 years, and I went to a Spanish school, and my sister never even learned to speak English. She was 6 months when we got there. So my whole life was conducted in Spanish until we moved to India when I was 10.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And how'd you find it there?
It was insane. It was wild. It was probably the most vivid memories I have are from India, but it was also a period of tremendous boredom, which is was painful almost as a child, being there in the summer and just having nothing to do, nothing. Couldn't go outside. It was 120 degrees. You know, my mother was saving herself from the heat in Canada, and my father was in the office. And just sit around and play Sorry. I'm sorry, we used to say.
Wow. You mentioned that you, one time you had, when you started writing, it was because of writing letters.
I think so.
What was that like? Can you explain that?
Well, I would start off at schools, paralyzingly shy, and everybody would hate me until I made a few friends, and I would just love them to death, and leaving them was painful. So I did everything I could to stay in touch, and I started writing a lot of letters.
How old were you?
I think when I first started writing letters, I was probably 11 or 12, something like that.
Did the constant moving or did the influence of these very distinct international cities, did that affect, you know, that has to impact you as a writer, as someone who's, you know, just writing about life and people. That how does that play a part in your upbringing in terms of the way you approach being a novelist?
Oh, everybody in my novel seems to come from a very small town because I think that was really exotic to me. I never lived in a small town. I didn't grow up with any kind of constancy with the same friends from kindergarten through the rest of your life. So I have this fascination with small town life, but I don't want to live there.
Right. But you think that some of the most interesting tales occur in that environment?
Well, my characters always leave their small town and go to places like New York City and, which is, you know, the center of the universe. Is everybody?
Yeah, you've lived there for a while. How did that, you know, influence you?
I think it gave me a veneer of sophistication and also permission to just be as yourself as you wanted to be.
Yeah. You lived in the village?
Yeah. I mean, I learned how to walk like a girl by following drag queens down the street.
Who were some of, you know, throughout your life, who were some of your own personal favorite authors?
Well, James Salter is my hero.
Uh-huh.
He just died this last year. And also Marguerite Duras and Amy Hempel and I couldn't have written my first novel without the work of Jane Ann Phillips, Black Tickets, and Michael Cunningham, Michael Ondaatje, the Michaels. I basically learned everything I know about writing from reading.
Do you ever get up sometimes and you just, you know, don't want to do it? Like, what motivates you to put pen to paper every day and to keep going?
It's a balance. There's the dread of writing, and then there's the dread of not writing.
Right.
And when the dread of not writing becomes greater than the dread of writing, then you write. It's kind of like a scale thing. It's a feeling of pressure inside of yourself. You finally realize everything you're doing is just not writing. You're not having a cup of tea. You're just not writing. You know. And then when it gets to that point, you just say, I'm gonna write.
Right. You can say fuck it.
Yeah. I'm gonna fuck it. I'm gonna write.
And are there any areas of life or any themes or any subject matter that you maybe have wanted to explore with your work that you haven't, that you might in the future?
I think I'm fascinated with fame, the effect of fame and the pursuit of fame, that everybody seems to want to be famous no matter if they have any talent or not. And so one of my books, this epic I've been writing for 4 years now, is about a band. Basically a singer-songwriter who rises up through the ranks and gets famous.
Right.
Yeah. So that's interesting to me, but I find that I keep writing about obsession. Like, you know, people who get obsessed with whatever, be it their career or another person. You know, sex itself. I write about sex a lot.
And do you ever think about, when you're actually writing a book, who would play that character if it were optioned into film?
Sometimes I play that game, but...
Because you never know,
no,
you know.
No, you don't know. I mean, yeah, I think that girl, Mia Warszkowski or something, it's a Polish last name, it's not that hard, but she was in Alice in Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland.
Okay.
And I think that she's tremendously talented.
Are there any writers today that are modern-day novelists that you like as well that are new?
Oh, sure.
Like
all
who?
The time. Department of Speculation, as the name of the novel. I can't exactly remember the woman's name, Amy Hempel. She can just break your heart over her knee in one sentence. She's amazing. I like writers that can write funny, because I think that's really incredibly hard.
Sure. It's hard to really, especially if it's like you're writing in someone else's voice or something. It's like, I've always wanted to, you know, I've heard mixed feelings about this. I've always wanted to, want to get other authors' opinion on what do you think about the whole New York Times bestseller system and how that's the end-all be-all about, because some people say it's not accurate.
Yeah.
Some people say that, okay, there's people who should be on that list who aren't, and certain people who are on that list who shouldn't be. Yeah. Do you think, is it like getting an Oscar? It's like once you're a New York Times bestseller, do you get to keep that forever, even though you say maybe your fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth book aren't bestsellers? If your first one is, you're a bestseller. So how does that work?
I really don't know, but I do know some. I've heard stories about some authors who will go out the first day their book is out and buy 50 of their own books, because it's the first day sales that actually knock you up into the bestseller list.
Right.
So if they get all their friends and they themselves, you know, buy a bunch of their books, suddenly there's a spike. And I just think it's a little rigged. And also, you know, it depends on how much publicity you're getting, how much you're... you know, publishing company puts behind you if you get interviewed, you know, if you have radio, if you get any kind of press. And I didn't get anything with my third novel. It was just thrown out there. They didn't even put a blurb on there or even an author photo that I got taken myself. So I just think I was a tax loss for them that year.
Wow. Well, some people have kind of, you know, finite goals. Like Tarantino said, I'm going to make 10 movies. I'd rather make 10 good movies than make 16 where 10 were good and 6 are okay. You know, quality over quantity. Do you have something like that where you're like, I'm going to write this many books, or do you just kind of, whatever the future holds?
Yeah, I'm not prolific. I don't want to let the thing go until I think it's perfect. And then, you know, once you have to judge yourself by perfection standards, it takes a long time to finish something. But then I'm just happy with the way they turn out. I have 3 other books I want to finish.
Right. But the next one, the one you're almost done with, is The Other Side of Me.
Right. Yes, it is.
Well, I can't wait till it comes out.
Oh, thank you.
It was good talking to you.
Yeah, it was great to see you again.
Good seeing you.
Yeah.
Take care.
A talented author, dedicated writer, a good person, fun chat. In time here, look out for The Other Side of Me, available on Amazon and wherever books are sold. I also went into the city, into San Francisco to check in with two friends of mine, singer-songwriters Theodore Atwood and Goose Ignite, in anticipation of their upcoming show October 12th in San Francisco at Brick and Mortar Music Hall. Fun guys to hang out with. Here's what went down. I want to thank you guys both for doing this. Carlos Bonilla, The Carlos Show, JakeRadioLive.com. I'm here with Theodore Atwood and Goose Ignite, who are performing on Saturday, October 12th at the Brick and Mortar Music Hall. For more information, go to BrickandMortarMusic.com. Brick and Mortar Music Hall is located at 1710 Mission Street at the corner of Mission and Dubose. For more information, go to BrickandMortarMusic.com. How you guys doing?
Good. What's up, Carlos?
Not much. Good to see you. Thank you guys for doing this. Goose, what's up?
Not too much. Thanks for having us.
My pleasure. My pleasure. I guess I want to start with you, Theodore. This is your first headlining gig, pretty much, on a Saturday?
It was sort of a surprising revelation, the way that all happened.
And how did that happen?
You know, I hit up Brick and Mortar. I was like, hey, you know, I'd love to play. And they were like, all right, let's do it. And next thing I knew, I was the headliner. And I was saying, hey, who else do I know who might want to be an amazing musician that night? And I was like, Goose Ignite, number one. I mean, first on top of the mind, you know. So I was like,
and as a headliner, do you prepare differently than you would say if you're playing slot or if you're opening for someone? You're headlining on a Saturday night in San Francisco. How does the preparation differ?
It differs in the sense that it doesn't normally happen for me in a typical everyday sense. So it's a really special occasion, you know. I feel really honored to have that slot.
Nice. And how do you feel about playing there? Talking to Goose Ignite.
Very excited about the opportunity. You know, when Ted presented the situation of he's got the show booked and they're looking for other acts.
Right.
It was exciting because it... to me, it sounded like something that you would hear from like the 80s or something, where they were like, you know, a venue's like, we've got no one, you know, we need some people. And then that was where the Cars played their first show or something.
Right, they turned to fill spots.
You know, so I thought, this has got to be, I can't pass this up. And this guy, you know, it's a good collaborator, friend, musician, and it just sounds like I couldn't pass this opportunity up. So
I don't blame you. Just mentioning the Cars, did you guys have any feelings when Rick Ocasek passed?
Oh man, well,
Theodore,
you know, I'm gonna have to quickly pass this back to my friend Goose Ignite, because he recently turned me on to the Cars and just the genius of their songwriting and their production. So please say more, Goose.
And it kind of wouldn't be Weezer without him. So let's be honest.
Which I did not know.
Yeah.
Until
Oh no. Yeah. That sound comes from the sound that crispness, that pop sensibility comes from him, and he gave that to Rivers and the rest of Weezer.
But sure.
Definitely, was like, as far as incorporating synthesizers, they're one of my favorite bands that brings in, it's, you know, their synthesizers and a guitar, mainly those two. Like, they're just one of the best as far as like with like pop sensibilities and catchy songwriting, but putting guitar and synth at the forefront, maybe more guitar, but like incorporating both in like a nice, pleasing setting. So that's obviously a huge inspiration.
A really tight way too. Like, and the songs are catchy and they're not too long. And that's what I noticed, you know, speaking of songs being just like really, you know, pleasant to listen to and not too long, I can say that about both your work. And you, Goose Ignite, I listened to your stuff for the first time today. I know some of Theodore's music, but this morning I got up and before I had coffee, I literally had a little mental note. Before coffee, as I was like, I gotta make it. And I put on your stuff, and it brought to mind to me the following: Pet Sounds era Beach Boys.
Ooh,
That was really quick. A little bit of Beck.
I think as soon as you hear Sleigh Bells, you know.
Big sucker for Sleigh Bells.
You Belong to Me. You Belong to Me is a great song, you know. But you also brought to mind not only Beatles era, but solo era John Lennon. Hmm. You've played gigs in the Bay Area, in the city for a while. You've been in a couple of bands. Do you find it hard to find gigs? And what's your take on the landscape of SF or Bay Area, the live music scene in 2019?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, this is my first live show coming up here as Goose Ignite, and I really haven't played a show, and it's been kind of a few years, like with the book show, so probably not even the most qualified to address what it's like playing shows out there. But that's one of the reasons why this was so such a good opportunity. Like, felt like it was a great time to get back in there. I don't really know, but I'm excited to like play the show and see how it feels being out there, and you know, hopefully make connections and kind of get it rolling. So I certainly hope that there's still. I mean, we know our, you know, we're dear friends with Craig of a number of bands, but Babes recently.
Caravan.
Two. We're gonna name drop some other.
Go ahead, please plug away.
We're plugging bands that we're friends with.
Down Dirty Shake, Caravan 222.
Nice. But you guys are bringing this up for the point that I'm trying to raise. It's so, like any publicity is good publicity for.
Well, yeah. The point I make is that our man plays lots of shows. They play original music, or he plays in a number of bands that do original music. So like we know, and we've been there, and we've seen, you know, cool venues, you know, Bottom of the Hill, Great American Music Hall, you know, like Amnesia, like nice venues in San Francisco where they're still appreciating original music. Great, so we know it's there. So it's exciting to, you know, get our stuff out there more, and you know.
You mentioned two of the greatest venues in the history of the city, both Bottom of the Hill and Great American Music Hall. So, I mean, that's, you know, there was a great article in a few years back in SF Weekly where the headline was the current SF music scene, and what you the photograph was a picture of a stage with mics with no one on the stage and amps and guitars, and there were two signs with arrows that says gone to Portland, gone to LA. And I think that encapsulated it, a lot of it for people, because no, it has died down. In this day and age, we live, you know, in the Bay Area and in San Francisco, Oakland, Berkeley specifically, I've noticed that there are less venues for music and less people going to see live music.
Yeah. I feel like I've really noticed LA has been drawing a lot of people, certainly over my lifetime. You know, a lot of the friends I grew up with in high school who really went pro in music, you know, of course they all went to LA, you know, so I don't know that many who chose Seattle over LA. So I would say LA is dominant, but also New York. So a lot of people are in New York now. Sure. As well. So it's
I think it's
LA
really, New York. I think it depends on the time that it's happening, you know. In the early 90s, definitely Seattle was a big mecca for rock bands and, you know, for independent artists and people wanting to kind of get their songs out there. On that note, and this goes for either of you, whoever wants to go first, when you guys create music these days and you're, you know, I know you're both big gearheads, I know you both a little bit. Do you find that is a lot of that created when you're walking around, or do you sit there with pads of paper, or how much is created in the studio? In other words, for either of you, and either of you could take this, how much of your tracks get created in the studio, or do you come in there with completed tracks in an outline that you flesh out when you get in there to record and hit that red button? Any either of you?
I'll say with a lot of, when it's a guitar-based song, I mean, it usually comes from, I'm practicing, you know, you gotta like stay sharp, so I'm practicing, and then.
How often do you practice, would you say?
I mean, it varies. I can't say I'm always, it varies. Like sometimes I'm practicing, you know, an hour more a day, sure. Sometimes not.
Practices a lot more than I do. That's why he's way better than
Well, but like, at least with guitar-based songs, it's often like I'm just practicing a lot, and then all of a sudden a little riff comes out that you know, you sort of slow it down once you've been sort of drilling for a while. So that's for me, like guitar based songs will start like that. You're playing and you're really loose, and then a little riff comes out.
It's like you strike gold, you know.
Yeah, you just sort of mining for gold.
Do either of you guys have a little sign of when something, I think it was some guy from The Replacements or someone once said, I know when I get goosebumps, when I hit a melody or a chord change. They have a sign that, okay, this is worth keeping. I play some instruments. I've woken up with, you guys will ever wake up with notes next to your bed of like, hey, I wrote this down. I don't know what it means, but I have a title and a.
I've been wanting to do that more, but I haven't much. But certainly the feeling, you know, it is kind of the way that other music makes you tingle. It's a similar feeling, and it's like, oh, well, if like my music is sort of making me like, get a little bit excited the way that other music makes me feel.
You don't want to lose that feeling.
Then, yeah, I want to, like, follow that.
So. Of course. You don't want to lose the magic.
I'll be like, oh, maybe that's a song. Yeah.
How about for you? Yeah, Goose Ignite.
That's definitely way up there. Is just general inspirations is, like, when you hear music that really inspires you, you know, makes you feel excited, you know, it's like you want to... and like feeling like you can, you know, that you can do the same thing, but you want to try to do the same, you know.
Sure,
it's,
sure.
It's just, you know, it inspires you to make something that would maybe make someone else feel the same way. So that's certainly.
But do you guys go into your studios with completed works, or do you end up composing in the studio and adding layers that you didn't initially think were going to be in the final mix, as it were?
I think for me it's both, you know. It's like sometimes I'll have a lyric written and maybe a guitar part where it feels like almost the full song already. Otherwise, I'll be more experimenting where I'll have an instrumental thing going and I'll keep playing with that, and then I'll start singing gibberish over top of it, and then I'll play with the gibberish, and then I'll come up with words for it. And some newer songs have been written that way, you know, whereas like, yeah, I think I feel more comfortable like just producing it from the bottom up, like starting with lyrics and then like adding music to it. But I think more I've been experimenting with different ways of just combining elements to create a song.
Right, right. Do you find that you, some certain ones you come up with the lyrics first and then the music comes later, or do you start, because you play a bunch of instruments. I heard your work this morning. There's keyboards on there, there's guitar on there. You take from a lot of, you know, just sonic areas.
Yeah.
What, do you find yourself writing like verses first in words, or the actual like, the chord changes in the music itself?
Well, occasionally, I'll really enjoy, like sometimes in writing a song, it'll be like, I have an idea for lyrics, and then, just completely independently is like a melodic idea. And then I'll kind of be like, oh, those might fit. So that's always been a really rewarding thought when I put those together, but they're basically independent at the time. As far as what we were talking about like a second ago, like pretty much the only thing I write, almost everything I compose gets written at home and developed. But then, yeah, like occasionally once I've already got an idea, maybe I'm out, you know, riding a train and think of extra lyrics or thinking about how I want to arrange something. But yeah, almost everything gets sort of written and recorded, and then there's a lot we can do within, you know, our programs we use to sort of enhance stuff.
We're all in this house getting very technical now in terms of our
gear. I've noticed.
Yes, so we're all very into synthesizers. We all have modular synthesizers at this point, plus keyboard synthesizers, plus Ableton, plus guitars. And at that point, VST, you know, plugins.
Okay, but let me ask you, okay, if there was this plus added to your performance upcoming at the Brick and Mortar, if there was this plus added, I asked you guys earlier this question just in case. You're at Brick and Mortar Saturday, October 12th. The power goes out. Could you in some way replicate melodically, harmonically, lyrically what you were going to do? Because I know both of you are going to go up there with different equipment and you're dialing in a lot of stuff. So if the power goes out, I think you each could pull off a good 40 minutes, hour on just vocals and...
No doubt.
I don't know.
Well, I mean, I sort of forget the layout, but I mean, if it's like, it's not really realistic to... I mean, if there's no, you know, if there's no power, I mean, it's like, it's harder to like project. So, I mean, I would...
Candles, baby.
I would want to give people a show. I mean, you know, if this situation happened where the power went out, I mean... Like, and there were lights still. I mean, are we in the dark? Or
candles, tap lights, okay, iPhones. So I think there are certain things that could provide illumination in case.
So we're playing a show. The power goes out. There's candles, but we're sort of still on stage, like, still fulfilling our time slot, you know, like.
We start taking our clothes off.
Yeah.
It's going to be hot, right? So take some clothes off, and light. Then we'll.
Yeah,
and someone's going to have an acoustic guitar, and so...
And the lights go back on,
I'm pretty
and...
sure between the two of us, we could fill, like, 2 hours.
Yeah.
Like, easy, right?
No, I would just try and... I would just try and play and sing as loud as... I mean, it'd be a little silly. I have to, like, probably make up some different, you know... Some songs in the set are, like, you're maybe singing softly. That's not going to work, you know, if you're going...
In general, it's not going to work. It's like, yeah, you're not going to have the same dynamic excitement that you would.
You got to sing hard. But yeah, I would figure out some shit.
All right, so this can go to either of you. How old were you when you started playing music? I'll start with Goose Ignite.
I was about 12 years old. I was very fortunate. My middle school had a guitar class, which I think by the very next year had joined like guitar with other stringed instruments. So... I was fortunate that my year it was just guitars, and I learned so much through. There's a, you know, we would like a little bit of sheet music in the class, but it was a lot of like people old, you know, kids older in the class that would like help me with tablature, sure. guitar tabs. So yeah,
sure.
12 years old, and
did you play any traditional band instruments, brass, woodwinds, anything?
I mean, just normal recorder and then into a clarinet, 1 year each. So that was really it. And I never really liked reading from sheet music.
You found it too binding?
It's
too strict?
I mean, yeah. Well, it just requires lots of patience.
Sure.
And it depends on your instrument. And with guitar, I mean, that's great if you're a classical guitar player. But I certainly loved how normal rock and roll bass guitar and just learning chords and all that with tablature and popular songs. Just it was great that was available. And
of course,
very fun and rewarding.
Theodore, how about you? How old were you when you first played an instrument and realized I love doing this?
there's pictures of me with this like, you know, kid's toy guitar that I think had like a speaker box of some kind with a microphone attached to it. And, you know, that would be, well, before fourth grade. But fourth grade is, you know, when they introduce instruments, right? So
right.
I chose trombone. And so, bum, 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 bum.
You like the bass slidey aspect of it.
Yeah, I just sort of like the sort of strong, steady note aspect of music. And I think, and then I picked up bass guitar. And then throughout
trombone had to be part of that desire to want to play a bass instrument, because with trombone you go between the tenor clef and the bass clef, so you can. But do you remember the first song you actually ever wrote that you're like, this is my first song, like my first composition?
The first song I actually wrote was on the patio of my mom's house in probably 2005. I mean, I sort of wrote song ideas, but I never like had combined lyrics with a guitar pattern where I felt like it was a coherent song until that year, sadly.
Do you remember the title?
I always kind of beat myself up for that just because I always like played bass in bands and I played a lot of guitar and I learned a lot of songs, but I never like really like wrote my own coherent song, I felt like, until
2005. What was it called? Do you remember?
This song. It was called Every Day. And it was about how hot it is in Phoenix. It was called Every Day I Wake Up, I Feel the Sunshine Beating Down.
Right, you just write what you know, basically.
It's hot on the ground.
Wow.
You can't even walk on it.
Wow. I mean, you write what you know. How about, what was the first song you ever wrote?
You write what you know.
What was the first thing you ever wrote?
You know, I remember...
Goose Ignite.
Practicing guitar from, you know, getting better and better... middle school throughout high school, and then by the end of, I don't even know, we were like writing a song by the end of high school. It was probably about smoking pot or something, and it was just like some cheesy chord progression.
Right,
and,
what you
but
know.
I remember, yeah, well, yeah. So
where'd you grow up?
California, mainly.
Okay.
East Bay, Northern California, middle school and high school.
What were some of your early influences?
Well, you know, Green Day was the big one.
Right.
That was the first sort of rock and roll where I was just very, very inspired.
Sure.
That one hit me too.
Yeah. So yeah, the Dookie album was just a monster for me. Otherwise, mainly in elementary school, I was into R&B. I liked the, mainly the All for One. Some Boys to Men.
Uh-huh. Wow. Dude, I met the guy from Boys to Men in the bathroom at the NBA All-Star game in Phoenix, Arizona in like 1994 or 5.
When I think of Boys to Men, I think of every gangster movie, and when someone dies in a gangster movie, it's like, it's so hard to say goodbye to, and like they're tipping their 40s or whatever. But Theodore, what were some of your favorite bands though when you were...
Guess what else happened when I met the Boys to Men guy? He had a bodyguard, and the bodyguard like stood in front of me and goes, his hands is wet. And I was like, hey, I just want to get an autograph. And the guy was washing his hands, right? And then he was drying his hands. And then I kept going, hey, you think you can sign this for me? And he's like, and the bodyguard kept stepping in front of me, between me and the Boys to Men guy, and saying, his hands is wet. I mean, I just like, I always think about that, and it was just very That was my experience.
Yeah, he's gonna. The bodyguard needs to. The bodyguard needs to guard.
A hand towel or paper towel. You know, did you offer to?
Well, it's so hard.
No, wait, wait. What I want to know. Listen. What I want to know is like, why does a bodyguard think he needs to guard one of the beefy members of Boyz II Men from a guy who weighs 110 pounds from Phoenix, who's like, how old were you, man?
I was probably 13.
Oh my God, you weighed 85 pounds. You're a skinny guy.
Very intimidating at that age.
Right.
Yeah.
That was huge. Yeah. I'm still right? huge. I mean, I'm huge.
Oh my God. Yikes. Okay, well, speaking of. Okay. Oh, wow. Damn.
Once we did. That's their song. Of-
I know. I'm well aware. Yeah. I'm well aware.
It's
I've
so
seen.
Hard to keep your hands dry.
I've seen gangster movies. Well, let me ask you guys this. Yikes. Yikes. This is the kind of stuff we can. This is the kind of stuff we can edit out.
This to me is seems like some of the more golden bits.
Nice.
One of the more golden bits.
Okay, well, let me ask you about other golden bits golden artists, people that golden inspired nice. You. Can I ask you guys if you got to name a favorite album of all time and why? What is it?
I'll go with Marilyn Manson, Antichrist Superstar.
Right. 1995. Great album.
Yes. Amazing album produced by Sean B. Vaughan, I believe. A guy which some guys I went to high school with got to know personally, and, you know, it's, like, fucking awesome. And, you know, that album just is a testament to mankind, and it is...
I could be wrong about the year. It's about 95 or so.
That album represents many things which rock and roll aspires to, which is speaking up to the man and speaking up to religion, speaking back to religion, and... If you have not listened to Antichrist Superstar, you should.
Where have you been living if you haven't heard that record? How about you, Goose Ignite? What's your favorite album of all time?
Yeah, I mean, that's tough, but, you know, as far as almost like that, where as far as like quintessential rock albums that really, you know, change the game a little bit. For me, you know, I'm a big Beatle boy, so, you know,
sure.
I would go with Abbey Road, the last thing they recorded together.
Right.
Just because it was like their best all around, there were strong contributions from everyone, and it was really just like
Somebody by George Harrison on it, which is a
something.
Also, sorry,
what's his other one? Well, he has his two most famous Beatles songs.
Something, by the way, was Frank Sinatra. Frank Sinatra once said that Something was his favorite song to sing by another artist. So. My favorite Beatle album is Revolver. People talk about how they think that their revolutionary album was Sgt. Pepper. I think they switched gears really on Revolver. I think with Tomorrow Never Knows, that was when the Beatles changed.
Yeah.
Because Tomorrow Never Knows was the transition.
It's
really, I don't know.
You can see the progression.
You said that Abbey Road has Harrison works on it. Who's your favorite Goose Ignite, your favorite singer of all time? Vocalist.
John Lennon certainly. I mean, Paul as well. But I definitely always been a John guy. More similar vocal range. So whenever I like to play Beatles songs at home, the John songs are typically in the baritone range. So I almost always like to sing John Beatles songs.
What's your favorite one to sing and play?
I don't know about a favorite. I've been singing Norwegian Wood recently. That's a nice range.
I think it's about weed.
Well, I was reading about it. It's apparently about a mistress.
Okay.
So
that's off Rubber Soul, I think, though, right?
Yes. Weed in your girlfriend's house, in your mistress's house, smoking weed.
Who's your favorite singer of all time?
I'm going to have to tip the hat to
Tom York.
Mr. Tom York. Thank you, Carlos.
Is
you know
that,
me
is
too
that
well.
Right? I know you too well.
You know, because...
I hear it in your music.
I mean, I have to
hear it in your music.
That people tell me that sometimes, but it's not intentional. Therefore, I realize that he's such a big influence. And, you know, he's just so amazing in so many ways. And I think has a sort of non-traditional style of singing, which I think has... liberated many people to sing in a non-traditional way and sort of experiment.
Sure. You can't describe what that man does.
He sort of experiments with his voice in a way that a lot of singers from days of yore, you know, are more traditional. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, I know when you know, back in...
Days of York.
One thing, when people talk about Nirvana's Nevermind, they never mention the fact that everywhere you went, whether it be your apartment, your dorm, Walgreens, A Car. That album was playing constantly. That was 1991. OK Computer was 1997. Yes. Same thing applies to at least San Francisco, because I was living there. Everywhere I went, whether it be a work party, a social, that album was on there.
Paranoid Android.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're saying that Tom York kind of, he sounds, his vocals sound like a DUI. That unpredictability and that chaos.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, the tires spinning out, the crashing into the wires.
Well, no, people have different interpretations of, you know, of sonic beauty. And you can't, there's no accounting for taste, as the great, late Frank Zappa used to say. Who played many shows? Who played many shows? You guys have a show October 12th. Describe what we're going to see on the 12th. What's your set going to be like?
Just like pure domination.
Yeah. How long you got? 45 minutes?
Like, I mean, like, picture the fire emoji, you know, but like...
On stage with the
keyboard. On stage with that. Well, there's no keyboard. I'm going to be playing guitar and singing and playing some pre-recorded backing tracks and just killing it as hard as one is able to do given those
parameters.
Right. That's a great word.
In the context of it all.
Context. Right. Thank you, guys.
How about you, Theodore Atwood? What can we expect? You're headlining Saturday, October 12th, Brick and Mortar. What can we expect there? How would you describe? Is it going to be new stuff, old stuff, a combination?
It will be a bigger show than you will see at the Warfield tomorrow night with Baby Metal.
Whoa.
It's right. Going to be a bigger show than Baby Metal.
Theodore's obsessed with Baby Metal.
I have more effects than Baby Metal has. I have more dancers. I have more band members. So please come to Brick and Mortar and watch me, you know, put Baby Metal to shame. I'm going to go see them tomorrow night, and then I'm going to take notes, and then I'm going to...
Add some of that to your stage production.
Make sure that my show is just...
Comparable.
Way better. Yeah. Like, way better, because I know it's already going to be way better, so... It's just a matter of time until, you know, I am just way bigger than Baby Metal.
Do you guys each get an hour? Is that you playing an hour?
Yeah, I'm going to play an hour. Goose Ignite's going to play an hour.
You can really play for an hour?
Well, we're still not sure, I guess, probably.
We're rolling.
We're sort of playing it by ear, but what we say is technically come out around 8 o'clock, and then we'll be there, and then we'll start playing music around 8 o'clock. And then
when do the doors open? 9? 7:30.
7:30, but you can come after that.
Nice and early. Nice and early.
Don't come before 7:30 because the doors will be closed.
And you're just a weirdo. No one goes to a venue that early.
And there's a bar next door. There's a great bar next door. You can get some amazing beer next door.
Nice. Well, I'm looking forward to it. That's going to be Saturday, October 12th. Doors open at 7:30. That's the Brick and Mortar Music Hall, located at 1710 Mission Street at the corner of DuBose. For more information, go to brickandmortarmusic.com. Thank you guys very much.
Thank you, Carlos.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And I really enjoyed both your music. You guys know that. That's why we're here.
Hey, cheers.
All right, cheers. If you guys want to check out their music, you can listen to Theodore Atwood at bandcamp.com. You can check out the music of Goose Ignite at SoundCloud. I'll say it one last time. Theodore Atwood and Goose Ignite will be performing Saturday, October 12th at the Brick and Mortar Music Club in San Francisco. Doors open at 7:30. Go to brickandmortarmusic.com for more information. Thank you very much to Kristen McCloy. Look out on Amazon and anywhere online for her previous works and her upcoming novel, The Other Side of Me. Special thanks, as always, to Malky Means King, B-Town Studios. Go to btownstudios.com. Want to thank my friends Chad and Brian Geller at Ultimate Ears. Go to ultimateears.com, as well as the folks at Blue Microphones, makers of the Yeti. If you guys want to drop me a line, please do so. The Carlos Show Mail at gmail.com. That's the Carlos Show Mail at gmail.com. Thanks, everyone. This is the Carlos Show on JakeRadioLive.com. Ginger Baker, rest in peace. The rest of you, be good. The sea.